Welcome to In Season, where we explore connections between people, plants, wildlife, and animals here in the Lower Columbia Pacific region. I'm Teresa Retzloff, and today I am sitting at beautiful Lewis and Clark National Historic Park talking to Kayla Furman. She's the Natural Resource and GIS Program Manager here. Hi, Kayla.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Oh my gosh, thanks so much for having me and letting me come out here to this beautiful park. It's a pretty blustery day outside that we're recording this, but it's just beautiful and lush and green and so cool. And it's I've been thinking a lot about the topic I wanted to talk to you about lately, because we're at a time of year when I'm recording this, it's winter thinking about spring, and we're starting to see some buds happening, maybe starting to see some insects emerging. And there is a whole topic of science called phenology. Am I saying that right?
Correct.
It's phenology, which is, as I understand it, and I want you to explain it better, it's like the tracking of when things happen in nature. Is that kind of it?
Yes, most definitely. So phenology is tracking the seasonal changes of everything out there. That's including when flowers bloom, when they produce seed, when the birds start singing and begin to nest, to insect emerging, to reproduction cycles. So phenology can encompass lots of different things, and we can track it in lots of different ways.
Is that something that you actually make an effort to track here in the park? I mean, for different species, or and why? Why would we track this? Why would we want to know?
That's a great question. We do make opportunistic observations. So when we are, for example, out in the field this time of year, we're counting elk pellets as part of our elk monitoring work.
Elk pellets is just a really polite way of saying elk poop, right?
Correct.
Okay, cool. Sorry.
That's a good clarification. Elk scat, yes.
Yes, okay.
And so we, during that survey, are making these observations of what is budding out here, because it is a long-term study. And we're doing it at the same time every year. And now we have a long-term data set of not only the elk scat and elk use of the park, but we also now know at the same week or same weeks every year what is blooming, what is dying back, and what changes we're seeing, and we're able to see those changes. We're also looking at migratory birds, bats, and in order to support our restoration efforts, are looking at seed production of native plants and timing that when we, so we can go out and collect the appropriate seed at the appropriate time.
How long has this elk scat survey been going on?
Since 2008.
So that's quite a while now that you've got data. Are you seeing any changes? Are you seeing any unusual anomalies in different years? Because here's the thing, and partly why I wanted to talk to someone about this, and you guys seem like a really good fit because you have this huge national park that you monitor and you're observing things all the time, and there's lots of science going on here. But, you know, for me on my farm that I run out in Olney, you know, I feel like, and talking to other farmers and gardeners too, you know, we're always saying like, gosh, it seems really early this year, or wow, there's a snow in March or April, or the flowers are blooming, or the birds feel late this year. But we're just kind of throwing it out there. Mm-hmm. But you guys actually have data that you're recording. And I'm just curious, are we all crazy, or are things actually changing?
During my time, I definitely have noticed a shift. For example, we monitor our tidal wetland sites at peak vegetation. So we're looking for when everything is in flower and beginning to produce seed. And we typically conducted those surveys the first week of August. So from 2006 until 2018, 2019, we were conducting them the first week of August, and we were finding in 2019 that things were already setting seed. And when we want to be able to identify a plant down to species, there's some characteristics that we really need, and plant parts that we that are critical to do that identification. And so
before they set seed.
Before they set seed. Or we need some flower and some seed. And therefore, the past couple of years, we've bumped the survey a week before and now 2 weeks before that initial timing, in order to make sure that we have all of the plant parts that we need to be able to identify them.
So plants are ending earlier. Do you think that they're starting earlier? I mean, because isn't it a time, like it's a time, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I know for in, you know, most like farm plants or crops, you have like days to maturity or days to, you know, harvest or yield. And a plant generally has a kind of life cycle from when it emerges, you know, flowers, you know, sets fruit or seed or whatever, and then dies back. Are you seeing that here too? So would the logical assumption be that they're actually emerging or flowering earlier, like up to 2 weeks earlier?
That could definitely be a possibility. I'd like to give a historical context here. So obviously we're at Lewis and Clark National Historical Park that commemorates the Lewis and Clark expedition. The expedition was here at Fort Clatsop in the winter of 1805 to 1806. They left Fort Clatsop on March 23rd, 1806. And on March 24th, they are paddling in the area between Napa and Brownsmead, and right in the weather journal, a brown briary shrub with a broad pinnate leaf has begun to forth its leaves. The polecat colewort is in bloom. And so there's reference to two plants there. This broad pinnately leaf plant that has thorns. So this could be based on Moulton, could be salmonberry. It could also be any rose or rubus species. So we have our native trailing blackberry, but most likely salmonberry because he describes it as such earlier in the journals. And then the second plant, which is a little more mysterious to us all, polecat colewort.
Polecat colewort.
Yes.
And is that what they called this plant out here? That's how they referred to it.
That's how Lewis and Clark referred to this plant. And so they're using common language. Polecat, they refer multiple times as a skunk.
Mm-hmm.
It's not actually a skunk.
I know what you're talking about.
It's a wild ferret. But in the journals, they describe polecat. So a skunk. And then colewort is another name for cabbage.
Uh-huh.
So they're describing skunk cabbage.
And that's at the end of March.
This is on March 24th.
It's starting to emerge.
It's in bloom.
Oh, it's in bloom. Okay. Whoa. That's late. So I mean, for us, that's
so
late.
So it seems. And so I can tell you, I've been in the field all week conducting our elk pellet surveys. I'm observing changes in the forest. And the polecat colewort, the skunk cabbage, is definitely past emergence, beginning to bloom. The salmonberry has put forth its leaves, as well as the other rubus species are starting to.
Whoa, that is interesting. So I'll just, like, for the record, we're recording this on February 27th or 28th. So end of February. So that's a month earlier.
Yes.
Than Lewis and Clark. That's a big shift.
Yes. And of course, this is, you know, one
I know,
moment in
but,
time.
But that's kind of fascinating to think about, because, you know, one of the things that's always been interesting to me, and I think this started, you know, when I got into farming, and there's all these rhymes and things about when to sow different seeds, you know, plant your peas on President's Day, or, you know, different kinds of stuff. And weirdly, a lot of them come from Europe or from England, so they may not be relevant to North America or anything like that. But it's really interesting to me because some of them have seemed like completely irrelevant to my personal experience on the ground, because that's not what's happening, you know, when they're telling me to do this thing or not do this thing. And so that these shifts, these weather shifts are happening, and you have some observation there. Wow.
Yes. And it does have other impacts, at least on our monitoring. We typically don't deploy our migratory bird bioacoustics recorders until March 15th. That's pretty standard across the nation. March 15th is the special day where we are beginning to see peak migratory birds come through the flyways. However, a couple days ago, I was awakened by the birds, and they're really loud. And I'm like, should I be deploying them sooner? Am I going to miss any early season migration if I'm not deploying these recorders for another 2 weeks from now?
And is that what these, so you say it's called bioacoustics? Explain what that is and what you're using them for.
Yeah, so bioacoustics is passive monitoring. So we put out these recording devices in different habitat types that we're looking to target. And they start at a certain time. So they start an hour before sunrise, and then they record through sunrise, and then they, our bat bioacoustics have a different timing where they go towards sunset. And they record all of the audio waves. And then we're able to download the data and look at these audio files transformed as a spectrograph. And so we visually can see the waves on a graph and then can match those with different species. So, you know, different songbirds are going to have different frequencies. And so it's not just having to stand in a particular place and listen by ear, which takes a lot of skill, a lot of time and energy and resources. This way we can record every day from March 15th until August and know that, you know, what days and weeks are we having peak times of
and that's different for different kinds of. That is amazing, because a lot of times you don't even know that they're there.
Yes.
You don't always see them. I notice this. You know, there's a certain number of birds that I observe all the time on our farm, but I had a birder friend come out and take a walk, and he's very good, did an auditory survey, and he had this list of like twice as many species mm-hmm. as I was aware of that we had, that I never see these birds. But he's like, oh yeah, they're there. They're just in the trees. Clearly that's the sound. I'm like, But so to have a recorder that can determine that, that's amazing.
Definitely. And it does take human expertise to then go through and vet the data. But we're able to do this also with bats. We don't think of bats as migratory. So I'm not saying they're migratory, but they do move from winter roosting to transitional spaces to where they're going to reproduce.
Through the park, in different places in
the park. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this time of year, we can also record what bats are starting to be present in certain spaces, whether they be human structures or adjacent to a wetland, where we know that once the bugs start to emerge, there's going to be higher bat activity.
That is so cool. What an amazing amount of data. And how long have you been doing biomonitoring here, do you think?
The bioacoustics has been happening. The monitoring has occurred since 2017, if not 2016, for the migratory birds. We are one of a couple parks that are along the Pacific Flyway from Alaska all the way down to Southern California. That are doing this type of work. And the bat bioacoustics has been for several years as well. And it's really neat because not only our data is providing us this long-term understanding of this place and what sort of habitats we're able to host for the variety of different birds that are coming through, but also we can look at the data sets of national parks north and south of us and understand when they're leaving, you know, parks to the south of us and then coming back up here, or, you know, parks to the north of us when they're leaving and then when they arrive.
That's so wild that you're probably all capturing the same birds. Yes. They're just on a journey.
They are.
I just find that so fascinating. I mean, migration is so amazing to me, and just the way that animals move through the landscape, and it is so fascinating. Has it revealed to you, do you think, habitats or places in the region where maybe you didn't think there was a lot of animal activity, but actually there is a lot more than you think, or you're understanding, no, this is a really valuable habitat, and we need to expand this because it's getting used a lot. Do you literally hear that from the birds and the bats?
Results are definitely super preliminary, but based on my own experience and observation, areas that you may not think are critical are like really provide high value. So for example, we have a site that overlooks Colwort Creek, one of our restoration sites along Fort Clatsop Road. And it's a hillside overlooking this wetland, and the amount of birds as well as bats that are coming through there throughout the year are incredible. And of course, like, the park has worked to restore this landscape, so we understand its high value. But then to see the recovery of different species using that high value habitat is incredible, because it's pretty relatively young restoration site.
Yeah, Colwort Creek, I mean, that's certainly been since I've lived here on the North Coast, and I think like within the last decade?
Yeah, so Colwort Creek, the first phase was in 2007.
Yeah.
And then the second phase in 2013.
So that's a pretty fast recovery. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really encouraging, actually, to think about. I mean, in a sense, I feel like this, like, nature is pretty good at sorting itself out. Oftentimes, once we get out of the way, you know, maybe we like mop ourselves out of the room a little bit and do a little cleanup, and then things come back pretty rapidly.
Most definitely. It can be a really resilient landscape when we are able to learn from it, adapt, and figure out what we can do to either restore it, protect, and conserve it as it is, and then things rebound. The plants come back, the water moves in the way that it naturally will, and amphibians come back, and birds, everything follows.
That's really encouraging, especially in light of, you know, some of the ramifications of, you know, the phenology thing, you know, the pros and cons of that, you know, and what people often observe. And I know in recent years, we've had some springs that have been very confusing, mm-hmm. where you've had an early warm spell, all of these things have bloomed, and then all of a sudden we get a freeze or a snow, and, you know, like, insects are killed, you know, the bees emerge, and then it's too cold for them, or they emerge because it's warmed up, but there's nothing blooming. And it's kind of heartbreaking, because it's like, you can't control it. As a human being, it's like, I want to be able to say, wait, just go back to sleep. Don't come out yet. It's not ready yet. But that they're just doing what they do. There's all these indicators that they're getting that it's time. But then nature does something else, and the weather does something else. And it's kind of terrifying to think about the disconnect sometimes in these creatures not always being able to arrive when the food's here.
Definitely.
Because those are some of the ramifications, right?
Yeah. And so I think it's even more important, because we are observing these changes, that we conserve the places that we have, that we can restore even more habitat and do what we can to provide a variety and diversity of spaces as refuge for these insects and mammals, like everything in between. So that they can adapt, and the more variety that we are able to provide, the greater their survival will be.
Is it that, I mean, in some ways it feels sort of like a heartbreaking thing, but, you know, if you have more of a certain insect around, if you have one of these catastrophic events and half of them die, well, at least you've still got half of them. But if you only have a really small population to begin with, and half of them die, then you're starting to get into trouble. So I appreciate spaces like this. And, you know, I think about this in terms of, like, what, you know, what do you try to encourage you know, visitors to take away from this? You know, if I'm coming here and I'm going, wow, this is really critical, this is amazing work, what can I do? Is it like I can go back to my garden and plant things for pollinators?
Definitely. Plant native plants, plant pollinator plants. You can also volunteer to remove invasive species. Those put our native habitats at risk. You can participate in one of the Project Budburst citizen science, community science.
What's Project
projects.
Budburst? That sounds really cool.
Yeah, it's an effort across national parks to collect phenology data. So I know that Mount Rainier has an active program where if you're doing a hike up there, you can take a picture of a flower that's in bloom and post it on iNaturalist, and that information will be shared with park managers to look at those long-term changes. Even making any iNaturalist observations, whether it's a native or non-native plant, that information gets to the right people.
Well, and explain iNaturalist too, because this is something that's very cool. When I was introduced to it a little while ago, and not everyone might know about this, but I kind of love the citizen science aspect of it. So it's an app for your smartphone.
Yes, it is an app. So iNaturalist is a community science application where you can take a picture of a plant, an animal, an insect, and if you have an idea of what it is, you can put the ID and share other notes about it. It's good to have really clear photos, and then post it for the community.
There'll be a date and a date stamp on it.
Yes, a date stamp. It will also give the location. Mm-hmm. You can share other information, like I found this in a Sitka spruce dominant forest, just to give it some context. And then these amazing experts and people and neighbors and your community members are also on iNaturalist, and they will go in and confirm your ID, vet the species identification, and or give you a species identification if you didn't know what it was. And then that information can go to a variety of places. So, for example, any of the invasive species observations on there, I look at, and then I go out there and remove the English ivy. And
so people will take pictures of English ivy?
Yes.
in the park and say, you have ivy in your park?
Yeah.
Whoa.
And that's actually really helpful. And I'm like, thank you, because now I know where it is.
That's actually really cool. Okay, people, when you're hiking in Lewis and Clark National Park, take pictures of the invasives. So.
And also the natives.
And the natives too. Exactly. Yeah. But I mean, how cool, because a lot of times if you can catch those things early.
Most definitely.
That's the cool thing with a lot of the invasives. Sometimes they're just ticking away and no one's noticing it. No one's noticing it. And then boom, it's a huge thing.
Yeah.
But if someone can catch that first little tiny bit.
It's funny we're talking about this. So it's actually National Invasive Species Awareness Week right now.
Oh, I did not know that.
It is.
Well, now I'm aware.
And there's also in Oregon, we have a invasive species hotline where you can actually call someone and say, hey, I see this Scotch broom.
Where do you not see Scotch
broom?
Yeah,
I mean, that's kind of mm-hmm. one they would probably get a lot of calls about, but mm-hmm. you can report some detection.
Wow.
Species, and then they will call the appropriate land manager or private property owner to let them know, and also provide resources to deal and eradicate those different plants.
Are you feeling like you're seeing a reduction in invasive species in the park, or is it just still kind of overwhelming?
It's a constant battle. you know, vectors are people walking on trails with seed on their boots. You know, it's the small things that we don't really realize. It could be like you have some seed on your backpack and then you put your backpack down to have lunch, and then, you know, some
wow.
stinky bob appears on the trail there, and then a dog walks by as the stinky bob releases its seed, and now it's on the dog's coat, and then it spreads another way.
Wow.
It will be a constant battle, but it's a good fight to have. And we definitely see the areas where we have done some heavy invasive species removal. Those areas recover. They fill in with salal and sword fern and do well afterwards.
And those are all plants that our native insects have evolved to use.
Yes.
And to emerge and to know when to look for them blooming and setting fruit and all those things, which goes back to this whole dilemma of this larger climate change thing that we're all dealing with, of all of this stuff is kind of feeling confused. Nature feels confused lately, or maybe annoyed. I'm not sure which.
It snowed on Monday, so I'm confused too.
Yeah, it feels like that. And you know, the insects, the birds, they have to be confused as well. And so, I mean, the answer is like more and better habitat.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. That is the number one, the number one thing that's impacting most of the endangered species is habitat loss. So if we can create more habitat, preserve the habitat that we have, enhance the habitat that we have, then we can create a more resilient landscape.
That is certainly something to aspire to. And we have such a beautiful landscape here in this region. It's so amazing and vibrant and rich and beautiful. And it's one of the things that I think so many of us who live here value about it, how beautiful it is, all the amazing birds and species and wildlife and butterflies and things that bloom. And I don't want that to go away. I'm really grateful for the work that you guys do here, and really fascinated by some of these studies. I'm so excited that these long-term tracking studies are going on and collecting data. And, you know, and I encourage everybody, you know, who's listening to, you can do this in your own garden too. You know, again, if it's just your smartphone or whatever it is, it doesn't have to be a fancy journal, but you can just go out and take pictures when things start to bloom. And take pictures when the birds start to show up. Take pictures when you see the first bee. And then do that year after year, and you'll start to develop these stories and patterns.
Yes. Yeah. The observations in a journal or on your phone can be really valuable to look at those long-term changes.
So everybody, okay, this is our challenge for this year. Start documenting and plant more habitat.
Yes, definitely.
And maybe come out and help pull some invasive weeds.
We have plenty of Scotch broom that can be pulled, whether it's at our national park or on other public lands. Get involved. Yeah. Make a plan for Earth Day, whatever you're going to do, and you can make a difference.
Huge difference. Huge difference. And all of us together can make an even bigger one, so... Thank you so much. This is really inspiring. I started out feeling kind of nervous and sad about all the changes and the weather patterns, and now I'm feeling optimistic. So thank you, Kayla. If you've been listening to this but weren't sure who I was speaking with from the beginning, it's Kayla Furman we've been talking with. She is the Natural Resources and GIS Program Manager here at Lewis and Clark National Historic Park. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been fascinating. I always learn so much when I come here, and I leave inspired. So. Thanks for the time. And thanks to everybody who listened. And we'll talk to you next time.